KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherer's on sabbatical. After Fed Chair Ben Bernanke announced if the economy continues to improve, it will be time for the Federal Reserve to stop pumping money in to prop it up, the markets went a little bit nuts. Business writer John Talton joins us later this hour to talk about why. Also, film critic Robert Horton broaches the deadly D-word documentary. President Obama gave a major speech on climate change yesterday, and he said the Keystone Pipeline would not be built if it was shown it would have a significantly negative impact on the global climate. Joining us to give us the Canadian perspective on that speech, Vancouver Sun writer Vaughn Palmer with us once again. Hello, Vaughn.
Hi, Marcy.
So I imagine not everybody was happy with the president's speech.
Well, actually, both sides hailed it as a great victory. The people who want to build the pipeline said they can live with his statement, and the people who don't want the pipeline built said, oh, this is a major victory for stopping the pipeline. I guess it comes down to a single word. What did the president mean by significantly? He said that the pipeline would only be built if it were in the United States' national interest, and that the State Department is engaged in determining that. The key consideration is whether construction of the pipeline would significantly exacerbate the climate problem, not just in the United States, but everywhere in the world. And so that's the key there. He didn't say it would be built. He didn't say it wouldn't be built. What he said was it comes down to your determination of what he means by significantly.
Who determines that? I suppose it's him.
Yeah, I guess it is, and what he means by it. So if you recall, the State Department weighed in with a preliminary report on this a while ago. And what they said was that building the pipeline would not affect significantly, they didn't say significantly, they said substantially, the climate problem, because whether the pipeline is built or not will not affect whether or not the oil sands, tar sands, if you prefer, in Canada are developed. So the development will continue, the oil will be shipped out some other way if it doesn't come to the United States. So that's the view, that it will not significantly affect the climate problem. The other side of that argument is the one put forward by opponents of the pipeline, which is if you're ever going to wean the world off of dependent on fossil fuels, target number one should be the Canadian oil sands, tar sands, and the way to slow development of that, at least prevent expansion of the development, is to start cutting off the outlets to the ocean. So they don't say that stopping Keystone alone will do it, but there's, you know, opposition to the pipelines in British Columbia. Eventually, you isolate that source of fossil fuels, and so that's the goal. So, yeah, we go back to significantly. How will you determine whether or not it significantly affects development? Even if you don't expand development, current development, many people think is bad already for the climate. So I don't know. I think business as usual is, if you're going to go right down the middle on it, you say the president still hasn't said what he's going to do.
And I think people on this side of the border would agree with you. Well, let's talk about climate in a more immediate way, which is rain in particular in the province of Alberta. I saw amazing pictures this past weekend of the city of Calgary and heard that it was evacuated.
Yeah, huge chunks of the city of Calgary were evacuated. A very sudden rise of the two rivers that pour through the middle of Calgary, and just massive flooding. In fact, that whole chunk of the province of Alberta is flooding, other communities as well. Apparently just the water rose so quickly, the city had very little time to prepare. And the other thing is, it was the biggest flood, I guess, in the history of the province. So neighborhoods and areas that had not been flooded before were underwater. The whole downtown was shut down, for example. Many residential neighborhoods had to be evacuated.
I understand that the waters really have started to recede, which gives rescue and relief workers an opportunity to assess how much damage was done. And we're talking about billions of dollars.
Yeah, preliminary estimates range from $3 to $5 billion worth of damage. The Premier of Alberta has announced $1 billion in assistance to rebuild the province, but she says it's going to take years. Some of this flooding is so drastic that it has changed the way rivers and streams flow, has destroyed whole communities.
Anybody killed?
I think there are 3 deaths associated with it. That was the last count I did. They were lucky in that respect that not an awful lot of people were killed. This morning's update, they're still trying to get downtown Calgary up and running again. They have a huge festival every year in Calgary, the Calgary Stampede.
Yes.
And that, I think, goes in about 10 days. They say they're still going to go ahead, but the Stampede grounds were all underwater. The hockey arena where the Calgary Flames play was wrecked. The water level was up to about the 8th row. All the dressing rooms, all the electronic equipment, everything under the stands was all flooded, so they haven't got the preliminary damage estimate on that one yet.
I realize Calgary's the main seat of population in this province, but there was flooding in other parts of Alberta as well.
Yeah, a community called High River, God, there's an ironic name
yes.
for it, massive damage, and the river, the water is just moving down, like Moose Jaw, which is farther down the line, Medicine Hat flooded, there's never been anything quite like it. I think it's now they rate it as the second or third largest weather-related disaster in Canadian history.
And I think we could talk more about weather other times, but it's a fascinating. I'm glad that not more people were killed, I suppose.
Yeah, that's it. There was some. One of the interesting reports that's come out since the thing was that some of the initial warnings were evidence of samplings of groundwater indicating that the water tables were saturated through the province, so that there was no possibility of any runoff being absorbed. It just went straight down the river.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, we'll move from Alberta back to British Columbia, and a court has handed down a sentence in a story that we've talked about off and on for years.
Yeah, this thing has gone on for an unconscionably long period of time. 7 years ago, the sinking of the Queen of the North on the coast of British Columbia, a terrible accident, a straightforward one. The ship was going down the inside passage along the coast of BC between the mainland and an island, and it didn't make a course correction. It plowed straight into an island, ripped a big hole in its side, and sank. 2 passengers went missing in the sinking, so 2 people died. Others were taken off. And a court finally ruled last week, found the navigating officer of the ship, a guy named Carl Vilgert, guilty of negligence in the case, and he was sentenced to 4 years in jail on Monday. A very stiff sentence. The judge said that there really wasn't a precedent for what happened, but he was in charge on the bridge. The accident was avoidable. A simple course correction would have avoided it, and therefore he's responsible. He didn't make himself any favors with the judge, I think, by his own testimony. There was a feeling that he'd never really been clear about what was going on the bridge and why he missed the turn.
Well, from what I have read, he was on the bridge with a former lover, and
yes.
Something was happening.
The woman who was at the wheel of the ship, they had had an affair. It had ended. It was the first time they'd worked together. There's been a lot of suspicion as to that they were distracted. No evidence presented on that, but that was somehow or other the center of his failure to make the course correction. The other thing was he presented, in his defense presented, various other possibilities, including the idea there was another ship in the area and so forth. But really, the investigators for Transport Canada hired a submersible and went down to the wreck, which is in very, very deep water, and recovered the electronic logs from the ship. And what they showed was that the ship simply didn't make the course correction. Mm. It just plowed straight into the island.
I know that the family of the deceased are very upset that he's never offered an explanation, a sincere explanation. Are they satisfied with the sentence?
Well, I guess they're satisfied with the sentence, which is very, very severe. I noticed that one of the relatives said that she still wished that he would just say, "What the heck happened on the bridge that night?" It's a reminder, and again, the judge emphasized this. It's just a reminder that you're captaining. In fact, he's the navigation officer of the ship. You've got everybody's life in your hands on this coast. You can't afford to be distracted, and you can't afford to have something else on your mind.
His lawyer appealed the sentence. He's out. He's out on bail, right?
Yes, they're appealing the sentence. It has taken a long, long time on this. The investigation took a while. The Ferry Corporation then spent a long time battling in order to fire these people. That dragged out the proceedings. Police then laid charges. And whatever else you might say about the Canadian justice system, the wheels grind very, very slowly. And as you just noted, Marcy, this is not over yet.
Well, let's turn from, the business of journalistic angst and talk about a happy story. You have a happy story for us.
Wow, a right whale. So the last time a North Pacific right whale was spotted in the waters off British Columbia was before I was born, 62 years ago, and 1951, and some marine researchers have spotted one. The sighting has been confirmed. This is one of the more endangered species of whales on the face of the planet. They were hunted almost to extinction in the 1800s during the whale fishery. They were recovering in the 1960s, and then the illegal Russian whale fishery took out 600 of them. There are thought to be only 100 of them around, but one of them was spotted peacefully basking in the waters off Haida Gwaii having breakfast the other day.
Well, I was interested to see it was a Canadian researcher named John Ford and some colleagues. Dr. Ford had explored 50,000 kilometers of water without ever seeing one of these whales?
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful story. And when he got called, he was in the waters in one vessel, and he got called from somebody in another vessel. I'm looking at a story that Mark Hume did in the Globe and Mail newspaper in Vancouver. And so he gets this call, and he goes, "Yeah, right," But then the next morning, they find it themselves. There it is. I see Dr. Phil Clappin at the whale research at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center in Seattle is overjoyed about this as well. I guess it's the biggest news in the marine community on this coast in some time.
Well, Vaughn, we've got one whale. We need one of a different gender, and then it's even better news, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, wish them well. maybe the two of them will be having breakfast the next time somebody sees them.
You let us know. Vaughn Palmer, thanks for talking with us.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Vaughn Palmer writes for the Vancouver Sun. He's our guest every Wednesday on Weekday here on KUOW.
All right, silence your phone and grab your popcorn. It's movie time in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, reminding listeners to keep animals safely indoors during fireworks displays, and providing vegan recipes for the 4th of July with vegan chili dogs, veggie burgers, and other vegan fare at PETA.org.
64 degrees in Seattle. It's cloudy. We're expecting showers today and a high of 73. Chance of showers overnight and tomorrow as well. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high of 76. 1021, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Why all the turmoil in the stock market lately? Is Ben Bernanke on the right track? The thoughts of economics columnist John Talton in 20 minutes, but first...
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Okay, you've got the treat, the popcorn, the raisinette. It's time to take in a movie or two with film critic Robert Horton back in the studios with us. Nice to see you.
Hi, Marcy.
Robert, we've been talking about summer movies, and we don't normally think of summer as the perfect time to go watch documentaries, and yet two documentaries are about to hit theaters.
Yeah, they come out during the summer. It's funny. There's actually kind of a steady stream of that, and we don't talk about it, but we will.
Okay,
we will
so
today.
Great summer movies, documentaries.
That's right, and these two happen to be opening the same day, and they are both music documentaries, which is, if you're going to make a documentary, that is certainly a kind of a surefire way to go if you can get the, I suppose if you can get the rights to the music. But both of them just happen to be opening, and both of them are very tuneful.
Because they're about music. The first one got a lot of press a couple of weeks ago. It's called 20 Feet from Stardom. It's about backup singers.
Yes.
Who are 20 feet from the star.
It played at SIFF. It played at the Seattle International Film Festival this year. So people may have heard a couple of ripples from that. But you're 20 Feet from Stardom. It actually begins with, it's got a few big names. Bruce Springsteen is in there. And Springsteen talks about how long a distance that really is.
Is it far? 20?
Well, existential, ego-related, all kinds of things go into that 20 feet, and he's very aware of like, who are you if you can make that step, you know, into the spotlight. And the movie is kind of about that. It's about people who are these obviously really, really gifted singers who have this talent and who just are, sometimes are better singers than the stars, but they don't have something. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's the killer instinct that you sort of have to have, or just that enormous ego that, you know, I want to be the person in front of the band, and I will go out there. And some of them are a little disgruntled about that, or they're frustrated, disappointed. And some of them are like, no, I like being back here.
Well, I know that a couple of these backup singers, and let's just say it, most of them are female.
Most of them are women in this movie. Yeah, definitely.
I'm sure that there are male backup singers. They just weren't included in this film. A lot of these women have been doing this for years who spoke in this documentary. And I think they were on one of the NPR magazine shows talking about how they actually liked this mm-hmm. work. They were perfectly happy. One of them at least had put out a solo album, and it really, you know, was pleasant.
Yeah.
But it just didn't have whatever oomph that you need to have.
Yeah, whatever combination of things, and sometimes it has little to do with the music. It, you know, might have a lot to do with what you look like and how you're promoted and how you promote yourself and all those other things. So, yeah, that's really true. There's some good character studies and people who have been around a long time. And you think, why not? You make a good living. In some cases, you travel around the world because mm-hmm. you happen to be playing with the Stones as they're going through Europe, you know, or whatever. And it kind of, to me, it was also calling into question the audience's response. Like, why should we feel disappointed for these people as we're watching this movie? Gee, you didn't quite get the brass ring. Well, maybe you did. Maybe it's fine. You know, maybe it's enough. And so they show various levels of content with that amongst the people. And if you're a music fan, you might recognize some of the folks in the movie, because some of them have at least gotten to that level of awareness amongst
famous backup singer.
Like that, just a certain level of fame. There's they go into the story of a woman named Mary Clayton, Mary spelled like Merry Christmas, who is the voice on the Rolling Stones track Gimme Shelter,
right?
Which, if you think of that song, you will know exactly what mm-hmm. we're talking about, because it's an uncanny supporting vocal. And she tells the story of going into the studio in the middle of the night, was called in by, you know, the Stones, and just ripping it apart and kind of going into, you know, music history just for being a backup singer. There's a lot of cool stuff like that. So if you're, and you know, you get to see Darlene Love, and she like is reunited on camera with some of her old harmonizers that she was with in the 60s, and there they are, and they just go into an impromptu thing, and the blend is just exactly what it was 40 years ago. So it's I think if you like a certain kind of music, it's kind of irresistible.
So that's called 20 Feet from Stardom. I guess also music from the same, maybe a little bit later. The second film is called The Secret Disco Revolution.
Yes.
So who knew that disco was all about revolution?
I did not know that myself. and I lived through it.
And what revolution are we speaking of?
The movie kind of has fun with this idea, which is that we tend to pigeonhole disco as a sort of vapid dance floor related phenomenon of the 1970s. I know it's shocking. That took a lot of heat and got dissed a lot back then and still today. And the filmmaker is trying to make the case, along with a few sort of thinkers and academics who are quoted in the movie, that disco, in fact, advanced gay rights, African-American culture, and in some ways, he thinks female sexuality was brought to it was framed in a different way because disco paid attention to that in some of its songs.
Boy,
Summer, for instance.
I start hating disco? It sounds very intellectual.
That's the danger, that's why the movie kind of makes fun of that. At the same time, it's sort of putting forward this proposition. Like, he's got these the three actors who are made up to look like the Mod Squad, except really bad versions of the Mod Squad. Three people, and they are supposedly carrying around a disco ball. Mm. With them, and they're supposedly bringing this Trojan horse through this cultural Trojan horse into our lives through silly disco music. And at times he interviews the musicians who are confronted with this idea. Do you think there was a revolution going on? And they just have no, like, what are you talking about? We thought of the 4/4 beat was a good one at the time.
And we just want to dance.
You put the hi-hat on it, and, you know. So it kind of goes back and forth on that. Although it is kind of an interesting argument to make that maybe in its own funny way, disco was kind of smuggling some of these things in. There's a thought that some of the anti-disco stuff actually was responding to that, whether consciously or not.
Really?
Even at the time, writers were saying, you know, there's a certain amount of homophobia involved in the way people are going around talking about how horrible disco is and blowing up disco records in the outfield of Comiskey Park in Chicago in 1979, which was a kind of notorious event that got out of hand, actually caused a riot.
The disco riot?
At the baseball game that night, yes.
Wow,
yes,
disco I missed
demolition
that.
Night. Oh, well.
Is that in the film?
Yes, it is.
Okay,
yes,
so I can learn about it.
Yeah, this is a history of, you know, more or less history of disco.
Are these being released because they're music related, or you mentioned when we started talking about documentaries that documentaries do find their way to summer theaters?
Yeah,
does it matter what they're about?
I think the generally, no pun intended, upbeat quality of these two movies probably suggests why they're coming out in summer, and that's a good. It sounds like a good fit, and I suspect it will be. And I think there's a, you know, you think of. At least the 20 Feet from Stardom kind of recalls that movie Standing in the Shadows of Motown, which was about those session guys from the 60s who played on all of the greatest songs you could ever think of.
Had no residuals.
Yeah, and nobody ever heard, no one knew their names, and was a wonderful thing. So I think it's there is a track record for documentaries becoming really successful by focusing on, you know, these elements of music. And these two movies, even though Secret Disco Revolution definitely gets a little out there at times, but
if you like disco, you might like
it. If you were of the era, as I admit, you know, my graduating class at Blanchette High voted our class song as Get Down Tonight by Casey and the Sunshine Band. Other classes were doing, you know, had deep dish sorts of philosophical songs, but that was kind of
you got down tonight at Blanchette.
Those
two films, Secret Disco Revolution, 20 Feet from Stardom. We're going to leave music now and hop over to the world of fantasy cinema. And last night, if you were listening to All Things Considered, you might have heard an obit for a guy named Richard Matheson. Who was Richard Matheson, if people didn't hear that?
Yes, Richard Matheson died at the age of 87, I think 2 days ago, and was a great writer of fantasy in America, and was a guy who really influenced a lot of other people, had a long career, and kept churning it out all that time, and was one of those people who just had the coolest ideas. He just kept coming up with these interesting notions, and was a very skilled and talented writer, and was able to play that out. And I know Stephen King has often said Richard Matheson is the guy. He's the one person who influenced me more than other people. And that makes sense if you think of Stephen King as a creator of just sort of irresistible ideas.
Well, as I understood it, Matheson was a writer, and then he got tapped to write for The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
Which, according to this reporter, Netta Ulaby, The Twilight Zone came of age, and the writers, sort of fantasy insiders, knew that you were going to see some of the best writers working for that. So you would tune in for a particular author. I mean, you weren't tuning in necessarily for Brad Pitt and zombies. You were tuning in for Richard Matheson's words.
Yeah. You think of there were some great science fiction and fantasy writers who were involved there. And Rod Serling, of course, being the major one. And Matheson was a mainstay of that. And had these brilliant concepts that folded right into the Twilight Zone concept that were almost impossible to forget once you saw them. He also, you know, as you said, he was a short story writer and even a novelist before then, and he gave birth to some ideas that are incredibly durable. One of them was his novel The Shrinking Man, which Hollywood took and made into The Incredible Shrinking Man, which I believe Matheson was not pleased about. And they also changed his ending, which at first I guess he wasn't pleased about, but I think he came to realize it's actually a fantastic ending. It's a very, very philosophical movie, despite that crazy title. And another thing that once you've seen it, especially if you see it at a young age, it will really, really haunt you. And the other one is I Am Legend.
And that was the name of his book.
Yeah.
But that was remade or made into a film three times.
Yeah.
Only the last one had the name I Am Legend.
Yes, yes. I'm not sure why, but yeah. The one with Will Smith from a few years ago, yeah.
And somebody credited him in this story that I heard with sort of birthing the current vampire craze. I don't know whether you hold to that notion.
I don't know about that, but I think he just that idea of the last guy who's around after plug in whatever apocalypse you want, nuclear, whatever, you know, it's not even just the fascination of defending himself against vampire zombies, whatever the bad guys are in that. It's just that idea of being alone and having this wasteland and having to create a life out of that. I think that's what's really cool about that. And if you think about it, he came to that concept more than once. When I was an adolescent, the TV movie Duel, which was one of the first things Steven Spielberg directed as a punk kid in the early 70s. It was it's such a simple idea. It's a guy in his car and this truck starts to bear down on him. And he's absolutely alone and there's no reason for it. We don't get an explanation. It isn't, you know, science run amok or a crazy guy. It's just a person in a truck who wants to get him. And so it becomes this kind of existential landscape where it's just you and the menace, you know. And in the case of that film, Spielberg did a beautiful job of visualizing that for maximum suspense, to say the least. And Matheson wrote lighter stuff too. He wrote the Night Stalker, which was one of the most successful TV movies of the 70s. Spawned a sequel that was shot in Seattle and a later series and all kinds of spin-off things, wonderful characters. So when I was thinking about him, I just thought, boy, this guy really was around during my childhood and all of these great touchstones of fantasy writing that he put out there for so many years.
That was Ray Matheson. Richard Matheson. Also, Ray Harryhausen died. Now, another name that I'm not familiar with, a British writer.
He was born in California.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But he came to be associated with Great Britain for many years. Ray Harryhausen died. Yeah, he died last month. And I thought when Matheson died, maybe we should lump them together because the fantasy world would have this huge void without the two of them. Harryhausen was an animator who was one of the pioneers of stop motion animation, followed in the footsteps of his heroes, like the guys who did King Kong, for instance, and was inspired to do that. And so in the 1950s and 60s especially, but going on longer than that, he created some of those movies that hit you at a certain age and like Matheson's work. and are indelible. He did alien movies like Earth versus the Flying Saucers.
Oh, my. Okay.
Which every movie that has traded in large-scale destruction, including a movie that's opening this week called White House Down, owes a debt to, because his flying saucers come down and they destroy Washington, D.C. And, of course, if you're 10 years old, that is awesome. he made Jason and the Argonauts, mm-hmm. which has this army of skeletons coming out of the ground at one point that were hand-animated stop motion. I mean, you have to be completely insane to be the kind of person who does that. All these elaborate visions and a mysterious island, the Jules Verne story, giant creatures coming alive. There's a kind of magic to that that is just really, really special, and that has been left in the wake of, you know, computer-generated animation, and not knocking that, but you just won't see this kind of thing again because it's too expensive, and maybe nobody's crazy enough to do that anymore. But it conjures up a kind of tactile experience that is very, very special.
And Ray Harryhausen worked for years and years, as you mentioned, he's sort of associated with British cinema. He won all these BAFTA awards, which are the British equivalent of, I think, an Emmy award, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, or Oscars, I mean, that level.
Why don't, I'm assuming industry people know him, why isn't he better known in popular circles?
Well, I think he's got his place in pop culture, and so if you're part of that kind of the appreciation for B movies and certain kinds of animation, perhaps he's an important figure. And I know I saw him once at SIFF. They brought him out for a little tribute, and he had some of his models, you know, which were a foot high, and these little clay, made of a variety of materials, but these things that he would manipulate so painstakingly, and it was great fun to see that. And he was also known as just a very genteel fellow, just a lovely guy who was probably remained somewhat childlike throughout his, I think, 90 years of life. But in his case, that's okay. That's fine.
Well, I'm glad that we had a chance to officially recognize their passing.
Yeah, those are a couple of giants for that world of movies, and we'll miss them.
That was Ray Harryhausen and Richard Matheson. Robert Horton writes about film for the Everett Herald, and at his website, The Crop Duster, you can find him every month at the Fry Art Museum, where he hosts the Magic Lantern film series. And, of course, he's our guest every week here on Weekday. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Marcy.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
A roundup of recent economics news with economics expert John Talton in a minute.
Back in the day, a theater was more than just movies and popcorn.
The historic theater in these downtowns is one of the few remaining true authentic sources of the community.
I'm Sarah Gardner. How one southern city is revamping its landmark theater and reviving memories. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
And you'll hear that tonight at 6:30 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Verity Credit Union, a nonprofit financial institution serving the personal and business needs of Seattle area residents and their finances since 1933. Information and resources online at veritycu.com.
65 degrees in Seattle, gradually warming up, expecting to reach 73 this afternoon with clouds and showers and possibly some thunder. It's 10:40. President Obama's trip to Africa in the news at 11.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. When Fed Chair Ben Bernanke announced it might be time to take away the training wheels, the markets responded, and it wasn't a good thing. John Talton writes about business for the Seattle Times, and he joins us every 3 weeks or so, and he's here today. Nice to have you in.
Hi, Marcy.
I think of there's some commercial, right, when so-and-so talks, everybody listens. I forget which investment firm it is. But so when Ben Bernanke says, economy's improving, time to stop propping it up, everyone flipped out.
Well, that's the narrative. Bernanke didn't exactly say that. But what a lot of Wall Street took away from Bernanke's talk was that the bond buying that the Fed had been doing at a rate of about $84 or $85 billion a month was going to be slowly tapered off as the economy got better. And Treasury yields have been rising, although the inflation-adjusted Treasury yields are not. I mean, they're back at about zero, so inflation's not a problem. The question is, how strong is the economy really? Wall Street has made a ton of money in the stock market through the hot money with the Fed expanding the credit base and the monetary base. That doesn't necessarily mean the economy is doing great. I mean, job creation is very slow. GDP growth is very weak. It was just revised backward. The backstory of this kind of mini panic is a banking crisis in China. China's economy has slowed down, and there is a huge debt bubble in China. There's a huge, largely unregulated shadow banking system, and it was the People's Bank of China, China's central bank, that a couple of weeks ago started to rein in this shadow banking system, cut back credit, and there was a freeze-up, very much like after Lehman Brothers, where one bank didn't trust another, overnight loans froze up, and that was what was really spooking Wall Street, was what was going on in China.
And is that because there's so much Chinese money tied up in the United States?
Well, the financial system internationally is very interconnected. China is the second largest economy, and so if China had a credit bubble that went boom, it could be very much like in 1929 when you had this emerging market economy that had suddenly become a huge player in the world that had a crash. And that country, of course, was called the United States of America.
There's in my reading, there's also another player, and I'm going to have to ask you to explain it because I really didn't understand it. Something called the BIS, Bank for International Settlements. What is that?
Well, the Bank for International Settlements, without boring your listeners, is, you might think of it as the central bank for all of the central banks.
Okay. In the world?
In the world. And the Bank for International Settlements was buying into this, we need austerity, we need some higher interest rates now, even though there is virtually no real inflation. And the statements out of the Bank of International Settlements after Bernanke were another thing that spooked the market.
So essentially we have Bernanke saying we might, if the economy improves, taper off this government investment, the Chinese unsettlement, and then this third response from the BIS saying we need more austerity measures. And all three of those combined spook the markets?
All of that. And the Dow is very high. And there's always the risk of, when is it going to collapse? You know, we don't want to be the last ones out the door.
I see. And so have things stabilized somewhat in the last couple of days? Because we've been seeing sort of Dow closing down, Dow closing down, Dow closing down.
Things have stabilized the past couple of days. And a big part of that was that not only were there more soothing remarks coming out of the Fed, but the Chinese central bank stepped in and provided liquidity, and suddenly the freeze-up in China went away. That doesn't mean the debt bubble in China has gone away, and it doesn't mean the Chinese economy is not slowing.
So they swept it under the rug for a little while?
Well, you might say that.
I did say that. Maybe I was wrong. We're talking with John Talton. We'll move from the world markets to the state of Washington, where we've been watching lawmakers do something for a lot of months now, and unless I missed it, they have yet to come to a budget agreement.
Well, have they done anything? I think that's part of the problem. One of the things that fascinates me about Washington and Seattle is that this economy is so strong and so diverse that it's as if we really don't need public leaders, because we have such a strong business community. And we are so blessed, and we had Bill Luck, Bill Boeing, Bill Gates.
Bill Luck, I like that.
But actually, public figures do matter, and public leadership does matter. And so we have an education system that's badly underfunded. Our flagship university, which is the major talent magnet here, has had its funding slashed brutally. And then we have transportation issues where we need, for instance, the Columbia River crossing that includes light rail. We need to have the connection to the port of Tacoma to the freeway system. We have a lot of our logistics surface streets that and highways that need repair and maintenance so that we can have trucking work. And this is all frozen up in the legislature.
Well, that's in addition. There's the budget, and then there's this transportation package. And I know Governor Inslee is most concerned about keeping Boeing Assembly in the Everett area in Snohomish County. And there's a lot of rumblings in the aftermath of the Paris Air Show, or actually during the Paris Air Show, that a lot of that work would go to South Carolina.
Well, South Carolina's legislature is not frozen up when it comes to issues like this. They will do anything it takes to steal our assets, as will a lot of other states. And so our elected leaders need to be aware of that. And right now we're living off the legacy of elected leaders who were courageous and invested in the future. And eventually that legacy is going to go to fumes and we're going to be in trouble.
Is it a leadership vacuum or is it a vision problem?
I think it's both. I'm not sure that the governor, nice guy that he is, knows quite how to do an LBJ on somebody, on a state senator, for instance. I think Governor Gregoire did much more than Governor Inslee does. And in the Senate, we have this tiny cabal of rural or small ex-urban senators who are controlling things, and they want to get away from this Seattle-centric focus. If it wasn't for Seattle, Washington would be Idaho. The money that Seattle brings in, the wealth that Seattle creates and Metro Seattle creates, funds all these rural counties.
Well, let's talk about Seattle for a second, because we're in the we're about a month and maybe 6 weeks out. I haven't do the math. I'm sorry. From our mayoral primary, we've got 9 people vying to be leader of this city. And I guess I'll put the same question, the leadership and vision question, to you when it comes to this municipality.
Well, it is not a great field to choose from because we're oftentimes having the wrong conversations about things. And as a journalist, even a columnist, I'm not picking sides here. I would say that Mayor McGinn has tried the hardest to understand the great reset that a city like this has to make in order to be competitive in the world economy, because we're not competing against Mississippi. We're competing against Amsterdam and Singapore and Shanghai. That said, he's made a lot of enemies. Among the rest of the field, saying things like, we're just going to pave the streets or put in sidewalks or collect the garbage, that's not going to cut it.
So what you're looking for is somebody who's going to talk about Seattle's place beyond Seattle.
Well, talk about Seattle's place as a competitive entity. Things like enhancing downtown as a destination for business. Things like listening to the business people in the SoTo area. Things like working with the port to ensure that the Port of Seattle is prosperous in the future. Things like talking about multimodal transportation systems, not just streets.
Hmm. It's interesting. You mentioned the SoTo area, and a lot of that conversation, the port as well, came up when we were talking about a basketball arena in that frenzy over the Sacramento Kings. And now there's sort of like a mini frenzy over a hockey team from your hometown of Phoenix, the Coyotes. And I had to laugh because I feel like Seattle is it's like the woodshed. If you don't cooperate with us, X city, we're going to send that team to the woodshed. They're going to Seattle.
Well, I'm from Phoenix, but I'm not crazy because I'm actually, I'm actually a native. You know, the Phoenix Coyotes face two problems. One is that they moved out to the suburbs to Glendale, where they were part of this big real estate hustle. And they're in financial trouble. The city of Glendale has mortgaged itself into like the 23rd century. You know, Star Trek Into Darkness will be in operation, and Glendale will still be in debt to try to keep this hockey team. The second problem is that Phoenix is a very poor metro area. It's the sixth largest city in the country. It's a larger metro area than Phoenix, but it has a very narrow economy. The wages are not high, and it cannot really afford four major league teams.
It has four major league teams?
It does, NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, and the NHL.
You know, forgive me, Arizonians who are listening. I'm from the north where hockey originated, and it just seems, you know, you're not a sports writer, but it seems crazy for the Southwest to have a hockey team.
Well, hockey was always big in Phoenix. There was a minor league team called the Phoenix Roadrunners that was wildly popular back in the 60s. But there does get to be a question of, do you have a metro area with a strong enough economy and high enough wages to afford that many tickets and that many business sponsorships?
And if you don't, we're sending you to that bad woodshed of Seattle. I don't think we're getting a hockey team.
We're not getting the Coyotes or the Coyotes. but the thing is that this would not be a deal like Chris Hansen's deal. Chris Hansen's deal is like a once-in-a-lifetime deal.
Finally, John, let's just go back to like hardcore business. The Seattle Times Sunday business section, I read the paper in its hardcover, you know, print edition.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm a subscriber. But I fascinating big article about CEO pay, to which you wrote an accompanying column about job creators. And it was not that self-same group of very highly paid CEOs. What the gist of it was, the gap, not dollar for dollar, but percentage gap between the average worker pay in these companies and what these CEOs were making. We were talking like 100 times more money, 200 times more money, 700 times more money. It was kind of astonishing.
Right. I mean, we are one of the most unequal nations on earth, and this has happened in my lifetime. I mean, there was a time when the average CEO made 50, 90 times the average worker's pay. Now the average is 350 times the average worker's pay or something like that. In the Northwest, it is lower than that. I mean, most of our CEOs are relative models of restraint. But public policy has been changed by powerful business elites to allow this, what some might say, looting of the corporate treasury to people who send jobs overseas and don't hire people. And that's tarring with a broad brush, but it's part of this inequality problem.
Well, it was interesting to see that two of our most famous companies, Amazon and Microsoft, were not those in which the salary was the highest.
Well, exactly. I mean, nobody should be hating Steve Ballmer, certainly not personally, the way so many people do here. He has a very restrained corporate compensation package, even with his stock options. And the same thing is true for Amazon, where Amazon has delivered these huge returns to investors. And even at a company like Starbucks, where Howard Schultz does get very, very high compensation, none of the shareholders are going to begrudge him that because he turned around the company. He's gotten great returns for investors. But then what we're not talking about is social rate of return. So the average American's wages have stagnated for years. The average American household lost 40% of its wealth in the Great Recession, and it has not been rebuilt. And the American middle class is being hollowed out.
And when we started this entire conversation, you talked about the fact that where we are in this Great Reset is having to think differently about the economy because jobs haven't been created. where the recovery has happened is in these boardrooms and in those shareholders' returns.
Sure. And, you know, we still have millions of people unemployed. A lot of the jobs that have been created are part-time or low-wage jobs. And if you look at the quintiles of income, the people in the lowest and the second lowest and the middle have been pretty bumping along stagnant for about 30 years or more. And in addition to that, the amount of salaries and wages as a percentage of GDP is at a low we haven't seen in decades.
It's interesting that this column came out, the article in your column came out also in the paper was a little squib about the Swiss vote to cap CEO salaries, which I think has gone into effect.
It has. And the Swiss put in place a say on pay for shareholders that is binding. We have say on pay that is just an advisory vote and it's very little effect. In Switzerland, it's really going to be put into effect. It's really having an effect. It has not tanked their economy. And here's the other thing. They've banned bonuses for CEOs who are hired and for CEOs who would here get golden parachutes.
I can't imagine that we'd ever see anything similar here.
Well, not until the voting patterns change.
Or the Great Revolution happens that you're fomenting through your columns there?
Thou sayest.
John Talton writes about business for the Seattle Times. He's on a blog as well, and he comes in every few weeks to talk to us about everything from the stock market to hockey. Who knew that you were such a versatile guy?
Well, I'm mostly a Suns fan, but I've been to Coyote games.
Uh-huh. And should that or some other team move up here, would you boycott it on principle?
Oh, no. I mean, anything that's downtown, I'll go.
I see. Sports is it.
And as long as it's not out in Glendale.
As long as it's not out in Glendale. Well, we can promise you that, or maybe not Bellevue either. Our show, produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. I'm Marcy Silman, and the man at the helm, Bernard Ouellette. Hope you can join us tomorrow on Weekday. It's, as always, it starts at 9 o'clock.
It's 10:58. The big news today is the Supreme Court's ruling that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. We'll be covering this decision through the day, what it means, what it doesn't mean, and how people are responding. We asked for your thoughts on this, and here's what one of you told us earlier today.
One of the elements that makes America such a great place to live is that all American citizens, whether your religion approves of them or not, whether you feel them worthy or not, can gain equal protections under the law and have the same standing. That's what makes America great. And of course, that's what makes this decision so profound. It tells the rest of the world, not just Americans, that all people deserve the same rights. If it's good for citizen A, it's also good for citizen B. And it's a great day in America, a great day for civil equality. Thanks.
KUOW listeners are responding to the Supreme Court's decision on the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Share your thoughts with us by phone at 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. Our coverage continues through the day. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
On the next Fresh Air, why the Lyme disease infection rate is growing, and so is the battle over how to treat it. We talk with Michael Spector about his article, The Lyme Wars, in the current edition of The New Yorker. He'll also tell us what's recommended if you find a tick on your body or your child's that might be carrying Lyme. Join us.
Tonight, 8 o'clock on KUOW 2.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.